Teisho will be on case 78 in the Blue Rock Collection, Bodhisattvas in the Bath. The main subject. In ancient times, there were 16 bodhisattvas. At the monks' bath time, following the rule, they had baths. They suddenly experienced realization through the touch of the water. You reverend Zen students, do you understand their words? We experienced the subtle and clear touch, have attained Buddhahood, and retain it. You will be able to attain this condition after 7 times piercing and 8 times breaking through. Secho's verse, the enlightened person is master of one single thing, stretches at ease on his bed. If in a dream the ancients said they were enlightened, let them emerge from the scented water, and I would spit at them. I want to thank everybody for coming here to practice today on this beautiful spring morning. It's just astonishing how everything has come to life. It seems overnight. Grass is a foot and a half high. Flowers in the beautiful trees. It's really amazing. Blossoms, everything's blossoming. Just seems overnight. Not long ago we were walking out of here and we had our coats tightly wrapped around us. So it's beautiful to be alive in the spring, and it's wonderful that you came to practice here today. I have to say that I was really very touched. You know, this is a period when many people have left campus, and I know that many of you have been working really hard. You have your jobs, some of you have jobs where you've been under pressure, and some of you have school work, and you just finished your exams. And it's easy to imagine, you know, it might have been easy to imagine not getting up this morning and coming here to practice. You know, after working so hard in your jobs, and after working so hard with your studies and writing all those papers and taking all those tests, you know, the more conventional thing to do would have been to reward yourself. You could have slept late, gotten up, and watched a little television and drank your coffee, and instead you got up early and you came here, and I think that's really deeply moving, really wonderful. As I was sitting in the Zendo, you know, periodically from time to time, especially at the beginning of each sit, I look around the Zendo to make sure everybody's ready to go. And, you know, I see people, their back straight, in the proper posture. Some people are moving from a Burmese style sitting into half lotus. And I see them carefully pulling up the leg on the thigh, and some of you are moving from like a half lotus posture to a full lotus. And I know myself what a challenge that is. You know, I realize that that's just sitting in the proper way is, it really requires great self-discipline and determination. And it's really moving to me to see people get up on a Saturday when they could be sleeping and come in here and practice. And then not only that, but make like a really strenuous effort, really, you know, really this strenuous effort. I generally sit every sit full lotus now, pretty much, because it really, I think, makes a qualitative difference in my sitting practice. It's not essential. There are people who have who are deeply awakened who don't sit that way, but it's a yogic posture which does produce a lot of energy and intensifies your concentration. So as a kind of as a help to awakening, it's very valuable. And I have to say that once I started sitting this way, I didn't want to go back because I really enjoyed the deeper concentration it gave me. As I say, not everybody sits this way, and it's not the it's not essential. It's not indispensable. And if you don't sit that way, you're doing fine. It's very important to sit, period. And it's quite challenging to sit, period. Some people are interested in this posture, and also they are pushing the envelope in their practice. This is one way of pushing the envelope. You know, you are going up to a wall or barrier in yourself, and you're going through that barrier. You know, and waiting for that barrier to dissolve or for the self to disappear, and then. There's this wonderful opening up. And we don't have to do it by sitting cross-legged. There are other ways to do it, working with a koan intensely, concentrating intensely, dealing with inner barriers. Those are all a part of the practice. But at any rate, one part of practice is working through barriers in with the body itself, in the tradition of yogic practice. So, when I first started doing full lotus, it was something I aspired to because, as I say, it helped my concentration quite a bit. It really helped me to avoid a wandering mind. And also, both Genki Roshi and Webb Sensei sat that way, and that's a sort of a normal way of sitting in Japan. People who practice in temples, at least monks and nuns, are expected to sit full lotus every sit. So the first time I did this, I could barely get through 10 minutes. And I would practice at home because I couldn't get through an entire sit. I would practice it at my house. And I remember I would just put the watch down next to me so I wouldn't, if it was on my wrist, I'd just look at it and look at it. So I'd take it off and set it aside, maybe at a little distance, and just try to concentrate and get into samadhi in the full lotus posture. And after about 10 minutes, I would look at the watch and see that only 10 minutes had gone by. And then I'd push the watch away and try to focus, and then I'd look again and it would be like, 13 minutes had gone by, and so on and so on. Getting to the point where I could sit for, say, 25 minutes or half an hour took a lot of time for me. It took me a long time, a lot of practice. And then it took me a number of years to be able to sit, three sits in a row, even with breaks, in the full lotus. You know, I would do one sit And then after many years, there came a day when the bell rang and I was thinking of uncrossing my legs, and I just decided not to. And I sat through the whole sit, and then I later did that again and sat through three sits in a row. And this took years and years. And if you don't understand Zen practice, you might think, what's this all about? You know, this is sort of crazy, isn't it? You don't have to... put your legs in that crazy position, and indeed you don't. It's not essential. I remember years ago, a teacher here at Rutgers asked me to come in and give a lecture on Zen meditation. And it wasn't in a religion class, it was in a psychology class. And most of these people were probably freshmen, or at least they didn't seem that mature, in my opinion. They were okay with the talk I was giving until I sat down on the floor and took off my shoes and put my legs in a lotus position. And they exploded with laughter and embarrassment. They were just so amazed by it, and they didn't know what to make of it. And I don't know, their reaction was very strange, I thought, but I guess they'd never seen it before. So it is kind of an odd thing. You can say, what is this Zen all about? You know, this is sort of just a cult, isn't it? You know, people come in here and they sit on the cushion in this weird posture, and then to make it even weirder, you put your legs up on your thighs, and you know, what is that? What's that all about? And it's easy to misunderstand what we're doing. You know, we're coming up to a barrier in ourselves. See, that the one way to do it is with the posture. One way to do it is with the posture. There are other ways to do it, as I said. You know, so for example, koans are another way of encountering a barrier in yourself. You know, you're sitting on the cushion and you enter deep samadhi and you're working with your koan, and you're using all your intellectual resources to work with the koan. So maybe the koan is something like one hit and one miss, or hot water, cold water. You know, so there are these koans. I'm talking about a koan right now, and subjects for meditation practice. And when we work with them, we try to deal with them the way we deal with many things in our lives, using the discriminating mind. So, you know, there's always this temptation to think we can, to believe that we can think our way through the koan, and that we're going to solve this like a puzzle, and sort of outsmart the koan. And maybe you're working on the koan hot water, cold water, which is basically saying you're a tea ladle, and the tea ladle goes into the hot water and it goes into the cold water, and it goes into the hot water and it goes into the cold water. Or maybe your koan is one hit, one miss. You know, two monks roll up two sets of blinds at exactly the same time. They're identical monks. They roll up the, one has a string in his hand and he rolls up a blind. The other has a string in his hand and he's rolling up a blind. They both roll up the blinds at the same time. The master points to one and says, one hit. And he points to the other and he says, one miss. See, you've got it, you don't have it. So these koans seem like puzzles, but when you start to work on them, you realize that your intellectual powers are not adequate for dealing with this question, which seems to the discriminating mind like nonsense. And this is very frustrating in a certain way. You know, it's actually very, I mean, people who don't understand Zen don't realize that koan training is quite challenging, because it defeats all of your intellectual abilities. You know, you could have, you know, we have people in this room who are going for advanced degrees. We've had physicists in our group, microbiologists. Some microbiologists are unable to get back into the country right now because the INS does not let them back in the State Department, and that's why they're not here today. So, you know, basically, you know, people who have pretty good minds, you know, work with koans, and they're reduced to infancy again, because that none of their intellect is going to help them work through this question. What is this hot water, cold water? What is this one hit, one miss? See, and so you know, it's a little bit like struggling with your body. Struggling with your body is like one form of coming up to a barrier in ourselves, you know. And another way of coming up to a barrier in ourselves is working with a koan. And we think, especially if we're somebody, kind of person who prides ourselves on our ability to think, you know, we think we're going to work our way through this koan intellectually, and then were reduced to stupidity, really, you know, like desperate stupidity. And we're trying to work our way through the koan, and nothing is working for us, you know. And so we're just sort of sitting there in a kind of blank state, trying to work with the koan. You can't even get your mind around the koan. And that's like, you know, sitting there trying to pull your leg up on your thigh. These are very closely comparable. One's with the body and one's with the intellect. But it's the same kind of thing. It's like you're coming up to a barrier in yourself. A barrier in yourself. And then you're working somehow to penetrate or to move through or move past that barrier. See, this is what Zen is all about. This is the essence of Zen. It's easy to one way to put it might be like this. It's easy to misunderstand Zen because people think Zen in particular and Buddhism in general are religions. See, they think they're religions. And I personally don't think that Zen or Buddhism are religions. See, because if this were a religion, you wouldn't have had to get up this morning whenever you got up and come here to sit. You wouldn't have to. Because, you know, in my opinion, you could have just slept in and gotten up at 10 o'clock. All you would have to do is just, like, believe. Right? It would just be about, it's about belief. It's about beliefs. Religion, in my opinion, is really, like, about beliefs. My feeling is that what we're doing isn't really about religion. It's not about beliefs, and it's not even about being saved. One way to think about religion also is that it's about salvation, personal salvation. You know, how can I avoid hell, or how can I avoid death? And it doesn't matter what religion you're looking at. You know, most religions really address those questions. Years ago, I was giving a talk on Zen practice. And I was talking about the way the mind works, and I was talking about meditation and samadhi and so on. And at the end of the talk, somebody stuck up his hand, actually her hand, and the person was very religious person, and said, "Well, what about death? You know, what happens to us after we die?" And the question really took me by surprise, because, you know, in a way I almost felt like saying, and I didn't say it, but it was just a surprise, because there's a part of me that just felt, well, who cares about that, you know, really? I mean, that's really not what Zen is about, you know, really, who cares about that, you know? This isn't really a religion. We're not trying to save ourselves, I think. I really don't think that's what Zen is about. It's about experiencing reality, experiencing the world, whatever it is. And it could be heaven and it could be hell, really, you know, more deeply. More completely and without reservation. There's a kind of element in Zen practice of wanting to know, you know, what is it? What is, you know, there's a great koan that just goes like this. What is it? What is this? See? Some people actually don't work with any of the koans in the Momonkan or any of the koans in the Blue Rock Collection. They just work with it. They sit on the cushion and go, what is it? What is it? What is it? See? It's not about being saved. It's about knowing. I want to know. I really want to know. See? And so whether I'm going to meet God or the devil or something else, you know, I don't really care. I just want to know. So that's a real element of Zen practice, wanting to know. And the other element of Zen practice is wanting to be one with. Right? And those two things are really very closely related, right? I mean, we don't understand the world, and one way to think about our situation is that we need to be saved from the world because we don't understand it. And I think that's a kind of religious approach. Another way to look at things is that, you know, we don't understand the world, and we think the answer is to become one with the world. See, and I think that's what Zen is all about, is trying to find out what it is by becoming totally one with it. See, so it may turn out to be hell, and it may turn out to be heaven, but I think this path is like saying, I'm going to find out by becoming one with it. Now, let me just say, fortunately, it's not hell, you know. It's wonderful. So far, I've been doing this for 30 years, I would describe it as heaven, like heaven. Today, I got up, and I came in, and I sat on the cushion, and had a wonderful sit. You know, it's like heaven. So far, so good. But the method is not really like being saved, it's being one with. See? So, you know, Zen is really not, religion. Or it's a very weird kind of religion, if you want to put it that way. Zen I guess the word for what Zen is, or the word for what Buddhism is, in my opinion, would be a Tao. The Chinese have this wonderful word Tao, and it describes like a path or a way of life. You know, this is like a path or a way of life. It's really not possible to walk this path and not change the way you live. See, I mean, some people get interested in Buddhism or interested in Zen intellectually, and that's because they're coming out of a tradition where they're coming out of a religious tradition, and so, you know, they read books on Zen and they like the ideas. Maybe koans are exciting to them, or they read a Dalai Lama on compassion and so on. And it's wonderful if people are inspired by these things, but actually, this path is a little different from that, because the ideas are really not what it's about. It's about becoming one with the world, whatever it might be, and that requires a change in the way you live. It's impossible to walk this path without changing the way you live. You don't have to become a monk or a nun. That's not important. Those are just symbols of walking the path. But what you do have to do is change the way you live. Is make a place for this practice in your life. And the thing that I found so moving today is that all of you have done that. You know, it's really moving to see people who are so dedicated to their practice. You know, it's so important. If you want to walk the path of Zen, it's so important to appreciate you know, what you're doing. Let me just, I was reading something the other day in the paper that I just thought was so astounding, you know. A journalist wanted to do an experiment. He recruited, this took place in Washington, D.C., at rush hour. It was 7:51 a.m. on Friday, January 12th, in the middle of rush hour. It was about an hour period, and this journalist got a musician. I don't know if any of you have heard of Joshua Bell. Some of you may have heard of Joshua Bell, but he's an extraordinary violinist, and he plays on like Stradivarius, which is one of the, you know, he's one of the greatest violinists in the world, and he plays on one of the best violins ever made, ever. You know, they're $3 million violins. And this journalist talked Joshua Bell into doing a little experiment where they went to subway in Washington, D.C. at rush hour, 7:51 a.m. on Friday, January 12th. And if you know anything about the subways in Washington, D.C., they're acoustically a lot better than the one in New York. The vaults are very high, and there's just a much more space, and the crowds are actually much larger. So anyway, Joshua Bell positioned himself in a strategic area and started to play his violin. And he played pieces that he had played at concert halls in Europe and the United States. And these were very beautiful, very difficult pieces. And for some of them, he had gotten awards. These are recordings had been made that won awards, or he had performed these pieces in musical competitions and won awards. So you can see where this is going. The idea was, we'll take this beautiful music, we'll take one of the world's greatest musicians, and we'll let him play at rush hour in Washington, D.C. in the subway, and let's see what happens, you know. So what do you think happened? You know, if you love music, you might imagine that. One way to imagine what would happen is that, you know, we could imagine that, you know, Joshua Bell would take out his violin and start playing this music, and people would be rushing to get to work, but they would begin to hear this beautiful music, this beautiful, you know, unearthly music, and they would pause and say, "Oh my God, what is that?" You know, and stop and listen. You know, so I think that both of them imagined it would be like that. That both Bell and the journalist who got him involved in this thought, you know, he'd start playing his music, and it would slow people down. They would turn and they would begin to start sticking to him as he played his beautiful music, and soon there would be a crowd and so on. But you know what? Not a single person stopped in an hour. Isn't that amazing? Not a single, actually that isn't true. One guy stopped and they thought, it's starting, right? He stopped, he leaned against the wall, he put a dollar in the hat, and then he moved on. You know, it was like he wasn't there for more than 3 minutes. Yeah. And then nobody else in the whole of Washington, D.C., you know, stopped to listen to Joshua Bell play music. Now, I think this is really important. I think this is, when I read this, I thought, this is very important, because, we imagine that it's easy to get into contact with beauty, reality, you know, truth, those kinds of things. I mean, we believe that if we see them, we'll know them, you know. I mean, I think most of us would imagine that, you know, if it were a kind of music we like, you know, we would stop and be arrested by it. We'd be open enough to reality to take this in, to notice it's the real McCoy, you know. But, you know, nothing in our culture encourages people to wake up. You know, nothing in our culture encourages people to wake up. So you know, everybody's under a great deal of pressure to get to work. You know, it's a Friday. It's January 12th, so, you know, basically all the holidays are over, and it's that period between the Christmas holidays and spring, and it's at the end of a week, and people are going to their last work day. They all have things to do, and they're got to catch the subway. They don't want to be late for work. And so they don't hear this beautiful music that's playing. See, and I think this is like emblematic of our culture, of our world. You know, we want to believe that, you know, when we're confronted with life in all of its beauty or all of its truth, you know, we're going to be able to respond to it. But so much of our culture pushes us in the other direction. You know, it's not, this culture's not about beauty or truth or enlightenment. It's about, in my opinion, survival, right? That's what it's all about. It's about survival, and it's about more or less making a money, right? You know? And this is not something that, you know, we can change. I think it's just the way the culture is, you know? Other cultures have had different values. I've mentioned before that in ancient China, all over China there were public temples where people could pursue enlightenment. And you could just decide that you wanted to become an enlightened person and start sitting, and you could go to a temple and you would be given clothes. You know, you would be given food, three meals a day, a place to sleep. You know, imagine, it would be like getting a scholarship to achieve enlightenment, right? And you'd just be able to say, okay, I'm going to check in here and practice. It might take me 15 or 20 years, but, you know, and they'd say, don't worry. You know, we'll take, the scholarship is yours, you know. Here are your clothes. Dinner's at 6, don't be late. Here's your bed, and the whole culture, basically supported this goal. If you look at like Tibet, even into the modern world, Tibet was very much like this. You know, mainland Chinese government. Was preparing to invade Tibet. I believe it was in 1958. Maybe it was a little earlier than that. And the Tibetan government was told, was warned that the Chinese, mainland Chinese, might be invading Tibet and taking over their country. And they had kind of like a parliament, actually. And the Dalai Lama was the head of state. And so what they should have done was to go tell the Dalai Lama that the Chinese were about to invade. But the Dalai Lama was in the middle of meditation retreat. And the members of parliament thought it over, and they decided not to disturb his meditation retreat. And you could say, well, those guys were crazy. They should have warned him about the impending invasion. But, you know, they knew it was going to be bad, but they valued this path so highly that they didn't disturb his meditation practice. See, imagine that. You know, I mean, in Japan too. You know, until the modern world, almost all people all over the world had to deal with a famine. You know, it might surprise you, but in Northern Europe, in the 18th century, there was a very severe famine, and many people in Scandinavia actually died from food shortage. This is really true. There's lots of records of like riot. I can't remember. It was a Norwegian poet. And he was writing in one of his journals, and he said, people came to my door today and asked me for some food. And he said, I felt so miserable because I told them I didn't have any. And he said, I really don't. And in other words, he knew they were going to starve to death, you know. So It was like that in Japan at one time too. You know, people would have food shortages. You know, you never knew if you were going to make it through the winter. And monks would come around and beg for food, you know, and people would give them, you know, you don't know if you're going to make it through the winter, but monks come and knock on the door with their bowls, and you they come to your house, and, you know, you give them some rice. Even though you don't know you're going to make it through the winter, people used to have that kind of commitment to enlightenment. It was the most important thing in the world for them, yeah. And they were willing to actually, like, not disturb the Dalai Lama with the enemy at the door, or, you know, give this monk the rice that you might need to get through the winter, because, you know what, enlightenment's very important. This is like a different civilization, right? Different civilization from ours. But, you know, all of you here came today to practice, to walk this path, you know, which is this wonderful, beautiful path that's not really understood very well, you know. When you sit on a cushion and you pull your legs up over your thighs, it's hard sometimes, right? It's not easy. And maybe 15 minutes into the sit, your legs really begin to bother you, you know? And I've been doing this for 30 years. There's various kinds of problems that can happen when you're doing full lotus. Your legs can sometimes burn. I don't know if that's ever happened to you, but they can burn, like they burn, you know, like burning sensation. You can get like a deep ache in your knee or in your hip. You can get a muscle cramp, and I've had my share of those, you know, having a cramp come up and have to keep your mind focused on Mu so you don't go, you know, jump through the ceiling, you know. So that's difficult in itself, and the mind gets tired, you know, it gets tired. And at some point you're sitting there in your lotus position and you're feeling like you just don't have an ounce of strength left, see. And you begin to think, when is that bell going to ring? I don't know if I'm going to make it through. And sometimes you don't, you know, you just go down in flames. But sometimes there's like a door that opens up in your being. And this it's like life rushes through that door. It's like life rushes through that door. And it's like all your miseries, you know, drop away. And it's like you're at the heart of life. This is what Zen is all about, you know. It's like you're at the heart of life. And at that moment you're like deathless and indestructible and one with everything, and everything's deathless and indestructible, right? And people in other times understood this, you know. The guys who would give rice to the men and women who would give rice to those Japanese monks, the Parliament of Tibet, all those Chinese people who supported all those monasteries, you know, they understood there's something about that experience which is really amazing and unique. And what does this have to do with listening to a violin? Well, you know, you can't really hear the violin unless you've properly prepared yourself, see? So it's not true that even the greatest violin player in the world, even the most beautiful violin, you know, a lot of people won't hear it because they're not ready to hear it. They haven't prepared themselves. The culture hasn't taught them how to be awake. You know, to hear Joshua Bell, you have to be awake. You have to be present. You have to be ready. Your heart has to be open, see. And if you're too closed up by your ideas and your presuppositions and your anxiety, even the greatest music in the world passes unnoticed, you know. And so that's sort of the the tragedy of the modern world is we have all this prosperity, you know, we have all this dough. I mean, not personally necessarily, but somebody's got it, right? Some people have a lot of it and some people have none of it, you know, but the thing is, there's all this money floating around, and yet it's like nobody stops and listens to the beautiful music of life, right? And so you had literally hundreds of thousands of people going through that subway, or tens of thousands anyway, and not a single person stopped to hear one of the greatest violinists in the world play his music. Because they weren't ready. They weren't prepared. The culture didn't prepare them. And they hadn't personally prepared themselves. And so like a moment of enlightenment just slipped through their hands. And any moment can be like that, see? Any moment can be like that. You know, when you sit on the cushion and you're working with your koan and you're struggling and you're getting discouraged and your mind gets tired and you go through all this self-doubt and all of this baloney and you keep pushing yourself back into deep samadhi, deep samadhi, deep samadhi. You know, all of a sudden, you know, you might just hear like the sound of the blower in the ceiling there. And it's the most beautiful sound in the world. It could be the most... I remember once we were having a session in a place called Moses Lake, Washington, which is on the eastern side of the Cascade Mountains. It's desert. Seattle is rainforest, but on the other side of the mountains, it's like a desert. And we had a session out there in the desert. And we would go to bed at night listening to the coyotes howling. It was beautiful. But the temperature was so hot. We had our summer session there. It was just like sweating from dawn till dusk. And I remember just sitting there sweating and sweating and sweating and working with my koan and getting nowhere. And then all of a sudden, I heard the most beautiful sound. I swear to you. It was like the sound of, you know, you talk about angels singing, something like that. It was the most beautiful sound in the universe. And I didn't know what it was for a while, and then I realized it was the fan. You know, and it wasn't beautiful because it was cooling me. It was just beautiful because it was present. You know, it was just the fan. And believe it or not, that was the answer to the koan. I won't tell you what koan, but that was my answer to the koan. You know, it was the fan. And anyway, you know, every moment is like this brush with perfection, or this brush with eternity, or this brush with, you know, enlightenment. But, you know, we have to prepare ourselves. And you know, coming here is really courageous of you, because nothing in your culture encourages you or supports you in your practice. It just doesn't. You know, this is, in the modern world, we have other values. But all of you got up this morning, and it's really deeply moving, you know, to me, to see everybody working so hard to achieve enlightenment, sort of in a society that doesn't value that, doesn't reward you, and doesn't support you. You know, everybody has to make great personal sacrifices to do this, and come to session, and so on. And yet, you know, you all do it, and it's so moving to me. It's so beautiful. It's really pure practice, if you ask me, because, you know, the motive is just the practice itself. You know, it's the only motive we have in this group is just enlightenment itself. There's no rewards, you know, there's no temple, no big temple. You know, when you walk down the street, you don't have, like, a silk robe, and everybody goes, oh, there's the... And it's not like that. You know, just quietly, everybody here is just quietly walking this beautiful path of Zen. And that's the purest practice. In ancient times, there were 16 bodhisattvas. At the monks' bath time, following the rule they had baths, they suddenly experienced realization through the touch of the water. See, I mean, we take baths a million times, right? Or at least I hope so. You know? I take a shower every day. You know? And, you know, we take, you know, you get in the shower, you're tired, and the water hits you, and it feels kind of good, and you soap up, and you wash, shampoo, or whatever, shave, and you get out and think, you know, now what's for breakfast? But, you know, these bodhisattvas, one time they got into the bathtub, and just the touch of the water caused them to those doors in themselves to open up, and they got into contact with the enlightened mind. See? And that's what this is all about. You know, anything is like Buddha. Everything is Buddha. And those bodhisattvas were laboring mightily, you know, just like you all have labored mightily this morning, you know, walking this beautiful path. You know, they too were sitting on the cushion, struggling with their posture and struggling to maintain concentration through half an hour, as sleepy, you know, and so on, hungry. And, you know, they're going up against a barrier in themselves and hitting that wall and hitting that wall and hitting that wall. And then, you know, they go to take a bath, and as soon as they hit the touch the water, you know, their minds and their hearts open up. And it's like being at the heart of the universe. This is Zen. This is what Zen is all about. Really, beliefs have very little to do with this, you know. I mean, I hope you believe that what I'm telling you is true, so belief has that value to it. But as I say, it's really not about, it's not about being saved from the world, it's about being one with the world. And there's really nothing to save, because everything is already Buddha. We just have gotten confused. Okay? So we're going through our lives like all those guys racing to the subway and walking by the greatest violinist in the universe. You see? But, you know, when we come to sit on the cushion, we come here to practice. It doesn't happen every time, you know. We all walk by the Joshua Bell types many times in our lives. But, you know, when you sit on the cushion and you face the barrier, it's like purifying your body, heart, and mind. It's like preparing yourself, readying yourself for that moment. And it may not happen when you leave here today, but it might. And it might already have happened. You know, and it may not happen today, but it will happen. This preparing yourself to hear, preparing yourself to touch, preparing yourself to, you know, and to feel and to see. And, you know, this is what Zen is all about. And it's, in my opinion, a beautiful path. So this is a koan today is like my love letter to all of you for coming here. Because I was so moved by the fact that, you know, some of you, you know, come here long distance. You might have slept on the floor last night, and I see you with your practice, diligent and committed, and it's just the most beautiful thing in the world. You know? And I wish we had a big temple and so on and so on, but we don't right now. But what we have is the best thing in the world. It's this beautiful, pure-hearted practice. And so that's just one, there's nothing like it. Secho's verse. The enlightened person is the master of one thing, this moment. Open heart, opening, see. Confronting the barrier in ourselves and working through, and then open. See, and as soon as it's open, you can hear Joshua Bell's beautiful violin, which is always playing somewhere, right? The enlightened person is the master of one thing, this moment. And it's always at ease, stretching at ease on his bed. You know, at some point that door opens up in yourself and all doubts and irresolutions vanish, and life in true trust is possible. See? And it's just like being at the heart of the universe, at ease in the universe. If in a dream the ancients said they were enlightened, let them emerge from the scented water and I would spit at them. This is like, remember that in Zen, sometimes what looks like an insult is a compliment. See, he's really saying, you beautiful bodhisattvas, you have struggled with the barriers in yourself day after day, month after month, year after year, you know, and you do it because, you don't even do it because you want to go to heaven. You just do it because you want to wake up, and your heart is full of love for this world. See, full of love for this world. Maybe you don't even know it yet, but that's really what makes us sit. You know, it's really like love for the world. This world is our true home, I think Zen is all about falling in love over and over again with this beautiful world. Like in bathing, the world is our bathtub, you know? Beautiful place to be. Thank you very much. Shujamuhan Segandor.